Hi, this is Ken McCarthy of Jazz on the Tube, and anybody who's been a regular listener, viewer, follower of Jazz on the Tube knows that we love New Orleans. And every chance we get, we want to remind people what a great place it is, how important it is to visit, whether you've been there before or not. It is, contrary to some people's strange misguided notions, it is not still underwater. There are actually people that believe that. No, it's on dry land, and the music is better than ever. In fact, my friend Ned Sublett thinks the music scene in New Orleans right now is as hot as the music scene was in New York City in the 70s, which is very hot indeed. And today we have a book that we're going to talk about. It's called New Atlantis, Musicians' Battle for the Survival of New Orleans by John Swenson. And I just want to start this whole process off by saying, get the book. Get one for yourself. If you've got a friend who loves music, who loves culture, who loves travel, who loves history, get it for them as a present. Get it for your local library. Nothing will put a bigger smile on your librarian's face than to see a really good book come in the door, and this is a great one. This book chronicles one of the most amazing stories in music history, one of the most amazing stories in mankind's experiment with urban living history, and really human history. It's the saving and the salvation and the rebuilding of a city that was almost wiped off the map by federal disaster, not a weather disaster, but a federal disaster, levee failures. And the heroes of this story are people near and dear to all our hearts, musicians, not exclusively, but largely jazz musicians. And John and I are going to get into this in detail in a second, but just as an overview, make no mistake, it was the musicians of New Orleans coming back, going through unbelievable hardships to relight the spark of New Orleans that got that city back on its feet. I mean, obviously a lot of people contributed, but the musicians' contribution was essential. So let's welcome our distinguished guest, John Swenson. John, are you there?
Yes, Ken. Thank you very much for the wonderful endorsement of the book and, by extension, the great comments you made about all of these magnificent human beings who helped bring New Orleans back through the force of their culture.
It's really one of the great stories of, I mean, certainly of jazz history. You know, if we look at, you know, we're all familiar with jazz starting as, you know, sort of in ragtime and, you know, going through the swing era and the bop era and the hard bop era and the free jazz era and that whole beautiful history. And this story has got to be considered one of the most important parts of the music's history, the music rebuilding a city. And I just want to give the title again for everybody who's taking notes, New Atlantis by John Swenson, and that's Swenson. First, let's give some praise to the publisher of this, and this is something that we talked about briefly, but I think it merits some attention. Tell us about the process of getting a publisher to recognize the value of this story and who finally stood up and did it.
Well, I worked on the proposal for a year because the idea was I had been covering New Orleans music since well before the flood. And when I returned to the city a couple of weeks after the flood, I became obsessed with interviewing the musicians who all had such harrowing tales about what they went through. And as more musicians returned to the city, the stories just kept building up and building up, and I realized a couple of things. It wasn't just another music story, and and the story about what happened in my house in Katrina became a cliche, but these musicians were literally involved in rebuilding the city. I mean literally involved in gutting houses, helping to build new houses, opening businesses, not to mention playing often for no money, playing without a place to live. And it occurred to me that these stories were too big and too interconnected to fit into magazine articles. And after a while, I realized I had to fashion something larger. So I conceived of this book idea, which there were so many books about Katrina and several outstanding books about the people of New Orleans before, during, and afterwards. Two that come immediately to mind are Zaytoun and Nine Lives. But this was a different book. This was about the musicians driving the recovery. And it was a difficult concept to sell. most of the my agent, Sarah Lazen, who's also Ned's agent. You mentioned Ned Sublette earlier.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
She sent the book around to a lot of different people, a lot of different publishers, and, you know, we kept getting that Katrina fatigue response, which the book isn't about Katrina. It's about what's happened since.
That's like saying, oh, you know, we've got Mozart fatigue, or we've got, you know, ancient Rome fatigue. I mean, this is a story for the ages. This is not some little news blip. That's my opinion.
Well, no, I understand what you're saying. It's just that's what we were getting back. And also, I was getting back responses from editors that were just looking at it as another book, music book. That one response that really sticks in my mind is the guy who said, why isn't there a chapter on Sissy Bounce? Now, if you read the book, you know Sissy Bounce is actually included because it was important. But it's not different chapters on the styles of music in New Orleans. It's a story about musicians. So, amazingly, a lot of editors just couldn't see what was actually in the proposal. And believe me, I worked hard on the proposal, and the proposal says what's supposed to be in the book. But fortunately, Oxford University Press, a great and prestigious publishing house, signed it to and released it here in the United States and as well as in England and in Canada. And the thing about Oxford that I'm very gratified about is that their track record is to keep things in print. And so I'm happy to think that when I'm not around anymore to relate this story to people, the book will be able to inform future generations about what actually happened during this period of time.
That's great. That's great. And lest anybody think that because it's published by Oxford University Press that it's a very, you know, dense, you know, hard to read tome. No, this is very beautiful writing, very clear, very accessible, and it is great that a serious press is putting its weight behind it. So thank you, Oxford University Press, for recognizing the value of American culture. I'm glad somebody does in the publishing world. Awesome. Let's remember something about the weeks after the we use Katrina as shorthand, but I have to because I'm involved with levees.org and because I believe this is important. I do want to let everybody know that the storm was nothing. The storm ripped a few shingles off a few roofs. It was the levee failures. I think 54 different levees failed after the storm as a result of post-storm surges as a result of bad engineering. This was a man-made, government-made, corrupt businessman's made disaster. So it could have been completely unnecessary. It did not have to happen. So this is just a small shout-out. But let's remember what those original weeks were like. I remember the dead silence in the which was so strange.
Yeah, there were no birds. There were no animals. There were no children. The city was deserted. You know, it was occupied by the National Guard. And the only people who were allowed to return were people with, you know, had essential jobs. And a few other people sort of snuck back in. But
And some of the very first in the city were the sounds of music.
As soon as musicians played even before the electricity came back on. But as soon as the electricity came back on, people plugged in and began playing. Coco Robichaud tells a wonderful story about sitting there in his car and seeing the electricity come back on. So he ran into Molly's at the market, and he plugged in and started playing. He played for like 6 hours, and everybody was dancing on the bar. And there was a curfew back then, but, you know, the National Guard kind of looked the other way in certain instances.
Also, it's interesting you mentioned the curfew and bars, because bars turned out to be very important social gathering places, news transfers places, finding old friends places, letting off the steam and you know, trying to deal with the trauma places. They turned out to become very important social institutions.
The landline at Johnny White's on Bourbon Street, Johnny White's Sports Bar. There are three different Johnny White's, but the one right on the corner of, I guess it's Bourbon and Toulouse, their landline never went out. So you could, even when you couldn't reach, you couldn't get in, get through to the city, you could call up the bar at Shawnee White's and the bartender would answer. I hooked up some Irish radio broadcasters to them. It was pretty amusing, actually.
Wow. One story that stands out for me, and there's so many, but one individual is the irrepressible Glenn David Andrews.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, member of the Andrews clan, who I believe is related to the Baptistes. I've never been able to trace the exact how they're connected, but the Baptistes, of course, the Lasty family, another
right.
great New Orleans family.
Right. Their grandfather, I believe. Ooh, I'd have to go back and look at my notes to trace all of the family roots there. But, you know, they all were connected in Treme, and Dr. John remembers going over there and hanging out. And he saw Trombone Shorty when he was a little kid, who was playing the tuba when he couldn't even lift it up, just laying down on the floor sideways. But to go back to Glenn David for a second, his grandfather was Jesse Hill, the man who wrote Oop Oop A Doo, and also was in Dr. John's first band when he took the Dr. John name after working as Mac Rebenack for so long. Glenn David Andrews, to me, is the star of the book. Of all of the people in the book, his story about being there before the hurricane hit, surviving and feeling like he dodged a bullet, like everybody did after the storm passed, and then dealing with the inundation, which affected his grandma's house where he was staying, and then he fled to the projects and was holed up there, and he finally had to get out of town because of the evacuation, and his story of the coming back and playing in the square where Tuba Fats had taught him as a young person, and also his struggles with his, you know, he had an addiction demon that he struggled with, and he battled it, and he had ups and downs, and he was very depressed, and he went into rehab at one point, but there was this constant evolution where he would make two steps forward and take a couple of steps back and then keep going, and how I kept running into him over the years and talking to him and relating these stories. He's such a great conversationalist, and I often had a tape recorder with me. So just seeing him talk about his life over the course of these couple of years, and then, of course, having this tremendous breakthrough, which you actually have documented on your site with the Heaven's Gate piece that you did with GDA. And then, you know, his sponsorship of the Baby Boys and the Aints Parade, which was just a triumphant moment for the whole Andrews clan. And now his presence in Treme, the HBO series. Glenn's story is really a wonderful illustration of the transformation that the musicians were able to go through.
And I think an important part of the story, it's a sad part of the story, but it's something that it's part of the story and it has to be part of the chronicle, is the very serious losses that took place. I mean, so many losses related directly to the levee failures, but then there were a lot of really wonderful young people, you know, leaders, artists, musicians, educators who were murdered after these levee failures. We could talk maybe about, I think it was Dinero Shavers who was the first to suffer that fate. Want to talk a little bit about Dinero's story?
Yeah, he was leading a group of young musicians, teaching them how to be. One of the things, I should back up for a second. One of the things that was missing after the flood was the marching bands, people who like to go to Mardi Gras, that's where they see them most prominently. And there were far fewer young people. The absence of young people in the immediate aftermath of the flood was staggering. And it took a very long time for these marching bands to reassemble. And in fact, this is a problem that had been occurring before the flood, and it's a political problem which is caused by the deprivation or the cessation of funds for music education in the school system in New Orleans. Now, I don't know what genius came up with the idea, but in a city that relies as much on culture and music history as New Orleans does, the idea of taking the funds away for the marching bands and to provide instruments for young people whose, you know, alternative is to join street gangs, that was really stupid. And it's an ongoing thing. The current governor, Bobby Jindal, is just against all forms of education, it seems. And he's piling on this problem. And so this is one of the things that the musicians did do to overcome lack of leadership from all areas of government.
Hey, John, do you mind? I don't mean to interrupt, but one related point I want to make is these marching bands had really high levels of musicianship, and they basically were the farm team for the whole New Orleans musical community. In other words, the path of development would be, as a little kid, you follow along with the band and just march along and just feel proud just to walk next to the musicians. And then, of course, then that puts the idea in your head, wouldn't it be great to be one of the guys playing? Then the next step is when you're in school, you get your instrument, you become part of the band, you get trained in your instrument. The next part of the evolution is you and some friends get together, create your own brass band, and stake out some places in town and play on the street. And if you're good, you survive, and people start asking you to come and play at parties and maybe even some indoor gigs. So these marching bands were really important. And I want to point something out. This is I don't think this is really a well-known fact of jazz history. We always hear, you know, about the great jazz, you know, our greats. And, of course, one of the greatest of the greats was Lester Young. And for some bizarre reason, not many people realize Lester Young got a big chunk of his musical education in New Orleans. He lived in – actually, there's some debate. He says he lives in Algiers. Or I forget. Either he says he lives in Algiers, but maybe he really lived in New Orleans. But anyway, these towns are very close to each other. And as a kid, if you find some biographical material of him, you will see that as a kid, young Lester Young marched along with these bands, the street bands, not the school marching bands, but the funeral bands and the parade bands. And that was one of his introductions to the whole world of music. So this street scene, this parade scene, this marching band scene, it's not, you know, the marching bands back home, as important as those are. This is a really deep, deep thing. So, sorry, John, go ahead.
No, it's true that you can... It's very difficult to find a New Orleans musician who didn't have a New Orleans jazz musician who didn't have a connection to the marching bands as a child. So these, some of the musicians took it upon themselves to raise money to get instruments for these kids and to teach them how to play in brass bands and in marching bands, and through help from great charities like the Tipitina's Foundation, a few other really important foundations. Denaryl Shavers had a marching band pretty much ready to perform in their first Mardi Gras when he was killed right at the end of 2006.
Yep.
So that was a great tragedy, and it really rocked the city's music community. It was one of eight murders that took place, I believe it was eight, in the space of a week. And a few days later, the filmmaker Helen Hill was also murdered. They both had ties to the Sound Cafe. And the people at the Sound Cafe organized a march on City Hall. They organized the group called Silence is Violence. David Andrews was one of the... He had been also involved in a teaching program at Sound Cafe, and he was one of the spokespersons. And Helen Hill was also one of the spokespeople for Silence is Violence, and they played a great role in the march on City Hall, which brought a lot of attention to this problem And I think, while it couldn't solve the problem immediately, it showed that the people were not going to, the citizens of New Orleans were not going to stand back and do nothing while the mayor and police commissioner refused to pursue these cases. This drama was played out very effectively in the second season of the HBO series Tremé, which detailed a lot of what we're talking about right now, and particularly the lack of the police, the homicide detectives, to bring any of the murder cases to trial.
And in terms of video, we actually have below links to video of the memorial parade for Helen Hill. We also have some very rough video, because I handed the camera to a friend of mine that really wasn't a camera person, but she did shoot, and it's one of the last, if not the last, performances of De Niro Shavers. This was at the Big Nine Social and Pleasure Club, their big parade. It was their first big parade after coming back at the end of 06, and it was a massive parade of thousands of people in it, and Hot 8 Band, which was De Niro's band that he played drums for, was one of the bands in that second line. So we have video of that, and of course we do have video also of Glenn David Andrews' remarks at that Silence is Violence gathering that took place outside of City Hall. So, you know, as if it weren't bad enough that the city lost just about everything, all its clubs, all its so many houses, hospitals, stores, traffic lights, electrical lights, sewage pipes, water pipes. Yeah, the weight of the water sitting, you know, 10, you know, some of these areas had 10, you know, feet of water sitting for a month. And that compressed the soil, which compressed the pipes. I mean, the rebuilding in New Orleans is easily one of the most heroic things that ever took place in America. Totally untold story, really. And that's why we're on this right now. And we're talking specifically about musicians and other artists. You know, as we talk about people like Helen Hill and the lady at the Sound Cafe, it was really all kinds of artists. And that's one of the beautiful things about New Orleans is there's a lot of communication among all artists. It's not, and I don't want to take anything away from New York. I grew up in New York. I learned music in New York. It's where I got my education and everything. But New York tends to be, you know, you're kind of very focused on your career and your band. And the clubs are a little antiseptic. You know, white tablecloths, big cover charges often, very, you know, the sets are by the clock. You know, and that's New York. New York's got to be that way. It's that kind of a city. New Orleans is another world. A lot of communication between the different musicians. It's not unusual for a musician just to wander in off the street and see a buddy playing and shout out, and then maybe even an invitation. Hey, why don't you come up here and join us, you know, that kind of thing. A lot of collaborations between musical artists, artists in other genres. It's a very, very creative, very human place. So if you'd like to take a look at the De Niro last second line or the Helen Hill Memorial Parade, that link will be below. And do remember to come back. We're talking about John Swenson's book, New Atlantis, very important book for everybody that cares about music and culture and New Orleans and just creativity in general. So if you want to see those videos, just pause and take a look and come on back. All right, we're back with John Swenson, and we're talking about his book, New Atlantis, Musicians Battle for the Survival of New Orleans, published by Oxford University Press. All praise to Oxford University Press for having the wisdom to put this book out there. We really, if we care about the music and care about just the creative spirit of human beings and, you know, care about New Orleans, we really should support this book in every way we can. Get a copy, tell people about it. Great gift for people that, you know, love music and love New Orleans and love culture. So we started out by talking about the essential role that musicians played in being the first, among the very first, if not the first, to come back and bring the city back to life. Then we talked about some of the really hard knocks the city took after the floods, as if the flood itself wasn't enough, and how they, you know, demonstrated resilience in that. Where do you want to go now? There's so many different things we can talk about. The book is rich and full of stories and personalities, and I learned a lot from the things that I didn't know about the rebuilding.
Well, I'd like to just, you know, put a little overview on it in the sense that New Orleans, in the course of something more than 250 years of existence has been wiped out numerous times by floods, fire several times. The city burnt to the ground and had to be rebuilt and was depopulated by yellow fever. It has overcome many obstacles, and it seems that each time a different economic engine has driven the city's recovery. Unfortunately, one of those was slavery. But, you know, the oil industry and the shipping industry, the sugar, at different times were the economic engines. But this time, I believe that culture is the economic engine that has driven the recovery. And Mitch Landrieu, who is the newly, well, elected mayor last year, as of last year, he is a great champion of Louisiana culture. He was the lieutenant governor before he was mayor, and culture was his big angle. And so he's really gone out of his way to try to help the musicians realize their goal. You know, in the immediate aftermath of the flood, the city officials got together and they came up with a plan that was going to include all of this rebuilding, a vast green zone of country clubs and golf courses and museums and casinos, a kind of tourist Disneyland style tourist destination for rich people.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a great outcry against this. And ironically, probably the thing that did most to stop it was the recession, because they were really on a fast track to make this happen. And we've seen in the destruction of a huge section of Central City for the new medical center, one of the illustrations of this plan, you know, at the same time that Charity Hospital, which could have been reopened, was not allowed to reopen. But at any rate, the point is that the musicians came back and restored the culture. They brought New Orleans back to a place where music is a central part of everyday life. We're talking about the difference between New York and New Orleans. New York and most places are, when you talk about culture and music, people pay money to go and sit in a chair and watch a performance. Music is part of everyday life in New Orleans. So it's a very different set of circumstances. The music is more in the streets there. It's as much in the streets as it is in the clubs. And it's as much, I don't know if you could say it's for free, because they're all different ways to talk about that. But it accompanies birth and it accompanies death and it accompanies everything in between. And that is the function that music serves there. And the musicians were forced to leave the city like everyone else, and they were often offered very good terms to reside in places like Portland, Oregon, and Austin, Texas, and New Brooklyn, New York. But when they got there and started playing there, they realized that their music didn't have the context in the community that it enjoyed in New Orleans. The music didn't have the meaning that it has in New Orleans. So they had to go back to New Orleans to reestablish their culture in order to give themselves a context to allow their music to be as spiritually advanced as it is there. It's not entertainment. And a lot of people before the storm, before the flood, thought of it as entertainment. And songs like Do You Know What It Means to Miss New Orleans and St. James Infirmary were considered, oh, these old songs that everybody did. Well, when these musicians came back, when James Andrews came back immediately after the storm, that's Trombone Shorty's older brother and Glenn David Andrews' cousin, his performance of those songs, which had been entertaining before, he brought real new meaning to them. And you could see they had new meaning for him and for all of the musicians who played them. So I think that the point of this book is that these musicians reestablished the unique culture of New Orleans through their music. And if you look at another large point, the United States is changing in character, becoming less of a manufacturing base and more of a place where software is produced and ideas are created and intellectual properties are created. And, well, this is what is driving the recovery of New Orleans in terms of culture. It's the intellectual property of the musicians. And I think it's a kind of canary in the coal mine for the entire country.
Yeah, I think so. I think for musical culture in general, because what goes on in New Orleans today is the way things used to be everywhere in the country. You know, the school band used to be a highlight. Live music used to accompany everything everywhere, you know. I don't know if you're aware, forget the name of the book, but there were second lines in Albany, New York at one point. There were second lines in Philadelphia. So New Orleans, in a way, is like the last holdout, the stronghold for America's musical culture. Because there's two kinds of people in the jazz world, those who've been to New Orleans and those that haven't. And I've been on both sides of that. When I was a young guy living in New York, I really, I didn't get out of New York. Frankly, literally for years, I never left the island. Brooklyn was a long trip. And I thought New Orleans was some history, ancient history place that had nothing to do with anything. And when I got down there, I was chagrined, at how just profoundly ignorant I was, that not only was New Orleans not history, New Orleans was sort of the eternal flame in some ways of America's music culture. The things that have come out of New Orleans, most people are familiar with the fact that, vaguely familiar with the idea that jazz got its start in New Orleans, but really so did rhythm and blues, the case can be made. So did funk, the case can be made. And to a degree, the sound of Motown was formed largely by the drumming of a New Orleans drummer who visited Detroit in Motown's early days, Smokey Johnson, and showed people in Detroit what drumming could be. And on it goes.
First recording in New Orleans,
Of course, Little Richard, and then when the Beatles came to America, of course they wanted to meet Elvis Presley, but the guy I think they were really awed by was Fats Domino. And then, of course, Louis Armstrong is a New Orleans native. Lester Young was born in Mississippi and was all over the country, but he spent his formative years right in the heart of New Orleans, and you can hear it in his sound, I think, and his approach to life and his approach to music. So not only is New Orleans important for the history of this music, but it maintains the spirit of it. And so I want to, besides encourage people to make sure they get their copy of New Atlantis, if you love this music and you haven't been to New Orleans, think about it. I'm going to tell you right now, do not go between May and, November unless you're really tough. Because I've seen grown men, multi-generation cane cutters, who still weep when August comes around because the weather is just so brutal. So, and don't think that you've experienced hot weather until you've experienced New Orleans in the summer. You don't know what hot is. John, am I lying or what?
Well, I have to take exception on one issue. I think everybody should visit Satchmo Summerfest at one point in their lives because it's such a wonderful, the annual celebration of Louis Armstrong's birth date, first weekend of August. And tough it out for a couple of days because the music is so alive. And, the earliest moments of jazz still live there. I might also point out that if you listen to Jelly Roll Morton, you're hearing the roots of everything that's happened since. I mean, you're hearing Professor Longhair, you're hearing Dr. John in there. And, it's just, New Orleans is a place that is not cut off from the past, even though it's it's certainly part of the future as well, but it's a continuum. The music is an ongoing phenomenon there, and I would like to endorse the Satchmo Summerfest, certainly.
Fair enough. But let's warn people, if be prepared to be hotter than you've ever been in your life. Is that fair?
Well, yes. I would not. I would recommend against being out in the hot sun between, let's say, noon and 4 p.m. Stay out of the sun.
Let's put it this way. I had a friend that grew up in Brazil, and when she went to New Orleans in June, she could not believe how hot it was. But if you're tough, and I think it is, it's certainly worth it to go to the Satchmo Festival, do that. And then if you want to be comfortable, you know, like December through April, you know, you have this lovely weather. You know, forget California. New Orleans in around March, when the, you know, in late February when the magnolia trees blossom. I mean, gee, you can't get much better weather than that. Hey, talking about tradition, maybe this might be a good place to wrap it up. And talking about Jelly Roll Morton, he talks about the Mardi Gras Indians. And this is a tradition that if you're in New Orleans, you can't help but see it everywhere, see influences of it everywhere. But if you're not in New Orleans, you may not even know what the heck it is or have ever directly experienced it. Can we talk a little about the Mardi Gras Indians and how important they are to the whole New Orleans scene?
Well, when Africans were brought to the United States as slaves in the early days of the colonies, they interacted with the Native Americans who were around, and they shared a lot of cultural similarities, and they were natural allies, you know, who shared, if you will, a common enemy in the colonists who had come to take away what the Native Americans had and had taken away what the African, now African Americans, had enjoyed in their homeland, that is to say, their freedom. So there was a strong cultural interaction from the very first days of their meetings between African Americans and Native Americans. And that, I believe, is the beginning of the Creolization process. The colonists who controlled all the official records were very afraid of the potential of the slaves and Indians banding together to revolt. So they suppressed this connection. But it's a long-standing connection. It's a blood connection. And it's a blood connection that's been hidden. One of the other main characters in New Atlantis is Cyril Neville. And one of the stories that it traces is his understanding of his heritage as not just an African American, but as a Native American. He found out through his uncle, George Landry, that there was Indian blood in the Neville family. And he went and researched it and found connections in the Indian nations and established those connections and brought some Native Americans on stage with the Neville brothers at Jazz Fest, and in turn they named him, I believe the Choctaw tribe named him the ambassador to the outside world for themselves. And this, the Mardi Gras Indians, of course, is a reflection of that. They're also called in the black neighborhoods the Black Indians. There was a French name for Black Indians. I don't know all of the details of this. There have been some really good studies on it.
So, and also a fair amount of the history and the culture of it is occult in the sense of secret and hidden. And it's part of it, as you pointed out, is, you know, nobody ever wants to give credit to these cultural forces. I mean, not that nobody does, but our official hates to give credit to these kinds of cultural sources. But on the other hand, a lot of the traditions of the Mardi Gras Indians are for the Mardi Gras Indian members only. Some of the history, some of the language, some of the meanings of the chants, these are not something you can just say, hey, you know, what are you guys doing? It's for members. It was, I believe, a survival mechanism, a survival training. Part of the Mardi Gras culture is just to deal with the tremendous strains and stresses Well,
it's absolutely true. I mean, New Orleans was essentially an apartheid city right up until 1965. As Cyril Neville points out, you had to, as a young black person, you had to be able to read so that, as he quoted his aunt saying, you didn't accidentally stumble onto death by, you know, drinking the wrong water fountain or going into the wrong restroom.
Yeah. So this tradition is, and there's some sort of an ancient connection, which is that during the French period, the Code Noir, which was the rules that regulated slavery, permitted for Sunday mornings off, and both Africans and Native Americans would congregate at a place that's now called Congo Square. And then you just understand how profound this is, because a lot of people just don't know this history. In British North America, it was illegal to play the drums under penalty of death.
Yeah.
Right? That's how frightened the Anglo-American slave enterprise was of the power of this culture and of music in general and of drums in particular. So really the only place in North America, and of course in Cuba and Brazil, it was different because that wasn't the Anglo-Americans, but the only place in North America really where the music was allowed any breathing room at all was specifically in New Orleans in a place called Congo Square, which happened to be a former sacred spot for the Native Americans. So there almost certainly was personal interaction between Africans and Native Americans. And by the way, not just African, you know, Africans from all kinds of backgrounds and tribes, people that might not have ever met each other in Africa who were thrown together in New Orleans. So some of the most, and some of our most important rhythms, a case can be made in American music, can be traced back to Mardi Gras Indian rhythms, in which case we're really talking about African and or Native American rhythms in a kind of fusion. So this is pretty deep stuff. And just one other point that every lover of music should know, that if you go to Mardi Gras, if you go to Congo Square and just cross the street and walk down, I think, two blocks, you're at the recording studio where basically rhythm and blues rock and roll was born. A Sicilian American, I always mangle his name, Cosimo?
Cosimo Matasta.
Yeah, Cosimo Matasta. People are, this is another little fact, but around the turn of the last century, the French Quarter was about 90% Italians, and they were treated pretty badly. So Cosimo had a great sympathy for blacks and black musicians, and he was the first man to record black musicians in a formal recording studio in New Orleans. And that didn't happen until the 50s. If you ever wonder, why are all these Louis Armstrong sides coming out of Chicago? Because if you were a black musician in New Orleans, you were not welcome in a recording studio in the city. And that took until the 50s, and it took this one man to break that. But the point, that's a sort of a side story, an important one. But the point I want to make is Congo Square and his recording studio, if you have a good arm, you could literally throw a rock from Congo Square and hit that recording studio. So there's something different about right, Rampart and Dumain, which is referenced in a lot of New Orleans music. So there is something magical about New Orleans and what goes on there and what goes on to this present day. And when you look at as John documents in his book, New Atlantis, when you look at the incredible heroic efforts these musicians made, they'd lost everything too. They lost their homes, all their possessions, often their musical instruments, their cars, their neighborhoods, their communities, I mean, their money, so such as they had. They lost everything, were pushed out of town by this disaster, and they were the pioneers that came back with really no help and no support, really, except from fellow artists, and re-enlivened the city. And wow, and the city's rocking now. I mean, you go down there now, you'd almost, unless you get off get out a bit and drive really around, you'd never really even know that this disaster happened. The main areas. And let's tell people where you should go. Guys, Bourbon Street is worth about 5 seconds. Where you really want to go is Frenchman Street.
Frenchman Street. Yeah. The new music capital. And they just, you go from where Esplanade and Decatur end, right around where Checkpoint Charlie's is. And you walk right down Frenchman Street, and you're going to pass a dozen clubs where The music just spills out onto the streets, and it's all kinds of music. It from the very beginnings of jazz to the very latest hip hop brass band connection, or the nouveau swing that Donald Harrison plays now. It's the whole history of jazz is on display, and there are a lot of young people there as well who are representing the newer forms of music that exist in the pop landscape. A lot of young people have moved to New Orleans because it's an affordable place to live, and it's a place to sort of rough it and have adventure. It's a good place to be young right now. Because the healthcare system is bad, and you know it's a very poor city. But if you can rough it and like adventure, it's a great, great place to be right now.
Yep. And if you love music, and if you get yourself, when you get yourself to Frenchman Street, because I hope everybody listening gets there, you'll meet people. It's a very friendly city. You will make friends much faster than you can even imagine, and people will fill you in on the other spots because there's clubs scattered around the city. Some of them are in odd places, and you just have to know where they are. And you'll figure that out once you get to Frenchman. But on Frenchman, what are there, about 10, 12, 15 clubs in a block?
Literally, yeah. I mean, every other doorway is a club. It's either a club or a restaurant. Praline Connection is there, and there's a deli, but everything else is a club. Yeah, there got to be a dozen clubs at least right along the two-block section of the Frenchman Street. I also would like to point out that all of this that we're talking about has been very beautifully portrayed in the HBO series Tremé, and we've had 2 years of it, and we're going to get at least one more year. And I would like to say that if anybody is a fan of the series and they are wondering what we're going to see next season, well, I think if they pick up a copy of New Atlantis, Musicians Battle for the Survival of New Orleans, they may get some hints about what will be in the next series.
Oh, great. Okay. All right. Well, we could easily talk about New Orleans and its history and what it continues to contribute and what it's been through and how it's evolving for the next month. But we'd have to cut it at some point, so this might be a good place. We've been talking with John Swenson, author of New Atlantis, Musicians Battle for the Survival of New Orleans. Just a great, great book. All praise to Oxford University Press for having the wisdom to put this book out there. If you love jazz, if you love the music, if you love New Orleans, my God, this is an obvious thing. Support this book. Best way to support a book, of course, is to buy it. You might have friends that you think would like it. Makes a great present. Again, your librarian, I'm sure, with all the budget cuts they're facing, would be delighted to see a book of this caliber in their collection. You never know what happens when you get the book to a library, how many lives will be touched by it. New Atlantis by John Swenson. John, thank you for taking the time out to tell us a little bit of the story. I know that the full story is vast and fascinating, and I am so grateful to you for making sure that this story did not get lost.
Thanks very much for your work, Ken. I mean, it's been very illuminating.
Great. Well, thanks, and maybe we'll run into each other in New Orleans or maybe New York.
Okay.
All right. This is Ken McCarthy for John Swenson saying goodbye on behalf of Jazz on the Tube. Get yourself a copy of New Atlantis.